I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The opening of Bach's St. Matthew Passion, his musical setting of the death of Jesus from the Gospel of St. Matthew, has marked in recent years a self-consciously modern introspection into the deeper meanings of this story. Who was it that killed the man who called himself the Son of God? As the Gospels tell the story, it was the Jewish leaders who said the Jewish Jesus had violated their law, and it was a Jewish mob that yelled, "Crucify him." It was Roman authorities in Jerusalem who carried out the execution by the Roman device of crucifixion. The story, of course, is fraught with mystery and meaning. The crucifixion and death of God as man is also for Christians the redeeming moment in all of time. It is God's ultimate sacrifice and gift to humanity. But in our time, the blame laid on Jews, especially in the St. John Gospel, which Bach also set, raises questions and misgivings for many people, for Christians as well as for Jews. Talking this hour on The Connection about the questions and the misgivings around the greatest church music ever written, more popular than ever now in the concert halls of the world, especially around the Easter season. Our guest in the studio, Julian Wachner, will be conducting Bach's St. Matthew and St. John Passions in Boston this week. From Swarthmore College, Michael Morrison joins us by phone. He's among the leading Bach scholars in the world, and he's the author most recently of a dense little book called Lutheranism, Anti-Judaism, and Bach's St. John Passion. Connection listeners, if you've sung this music, if you've been moved by this music, if you've been puzzled and troubled by this music or these texts, call in and help sort the strands of it. The Connection phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Julian Wachner, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
Speak as a performer. What are the questions raised for the people who deliver this magnificent music?
Well, I suppose let me first say that just this past 4 months working on both of these works has been an unbelievable experience. Last year when I bumped into John Harbison and he said, "Oh, you're doing the St. Matthew," Craig Smith said that will change your life forever. And I said, "Oh, well, yes, I'm sure it will," and it really has. It's not only because of the political issues and the theological issues, but because the work is just so incredibly staggering from humanity's point of view. Now, in terms of the whole anti-Jewish question or anti-Semitism in both of the works, I think it's important to understand the nature of these two passions and sort of to place them in the context of passion in 18th century Lutheran Germany. These works do tell the whole story taken right from the gospel, and it does that with an evangelist and a bunch of different characters. But in addition to that, there are a bunch of arias and some choruses that comment upon the work. And it's interesting to see how differently Bach treats the commentary than some of his contemporaries. And Michael, I know, is going to speak about this. But from a point of view of a performer, it's incredibly vitriolic music at times, particularly when the chorus is screaming out, "Kreuzige, Kreuzige, crucify him." And I think we all talk about the why there is anti-Judaism or anti-Semitism in the Gospels and how that is really traced to the first century of Christianity. But when you're in the middle of it, it's sort of hard to say, well, yes, it's because the early Christians were trying to distance themselves from their Jewish past and ally themselves with Rome, so that's why those issues are there. But still, the words are incredibly harsh, and the music is incredibly dissonant. I think a good example of this would be from the St. John Passion, where Pilate is basically saying, well, what should I do with this man who calls himself the king of the Jews? And the Jews themselves say, crucify him, crucify him. And what you'll hear is incredible dissonances, sevenths against diminished seventh chords, and really intense, probably the most intense chromaticism that anyone had heard up to this point in Western art music.
Let's listen. Crucify, meaning crucify him.
Absolutely. And the thing that you may not notice from such a beautifully refined performance, I believe that's the John Elliott Gardner and his Monteverdi choir, but a performer singing this, it's in the highest part of the range, and particularly if we're performing the work at modern pitch, it's you're literally screaming these notes out, and the sense that your body gets is of this angry mob and of this crowd, and there's nothing pretty about this, and there's really no way to whitewash the effect that it has on audience and performer alike. And this sort of music and singing goes on for about 20 minutes straight in the center portion of the St. John Passion.
There's another moment in the St. John that I'd like to hear and you to introduce, where they are in effect reading the law.
Yes,
it's right here in the book.
It's the most bureaucratic chorus in the world. And basically what's happening is Pilate sort of sarcastically says, well, you go take him and kill him yourself. I'm not going to deal with this. And the Jewish response is, well, we have an ancient law, and no one can be put to death on this holy day, because it was Passover at the time. So Bach sets this really brilliantly in F major with a very strict sort of bureaucratic, stodgy fugue saying, wir haben ein Gesetz, we have an ancient law. So this is another side of the same issue. So I think you can hear in that a completely different kind of music, one that is structured and organized and very sort of, as I said, bureaucratic. And it's at the end of this where there's this incredible shift from F major down to E major. Now, the effect of that, and this is where really it's decided in the story that Jesus is going to be put to death. And the effect of going from F major down to E major, if you turn a score page, what happens is a bunch of sharps appear on the page, and that really is a bunch of crosses. So it's sort of a trick that Bach does that.
A musical pun.
It's a musical. It's actually when... when I turn the page, whenever I turn the page in any performance, my heart sort of stops because the effect is visual. And yes, no one is perceiving that we're shifting from F major to E major, but all the musicians are perceiving that we are on the way to Golgotha and these are our crosses. And what's interesting is then we get the exact same music, only to different text in E major. So, and the piece is all based upon symmetry. I mean, that's a whole nother topic, of course. We could probably have 8 shows on these works, all on different topics.
First of 8. Michael Morrison joins us from the faculty of Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Michael Morrison, you were there, in effect, when all of this became a kind of modern controversy. How did it happen? What's the fight about?
Well, I think what happened was there was just a handful of students who objected to performances of the work at Swarthmore. And I guess the way I would put it is that they came with very reasonable expectations about what was going to go on. You had a well-known gospel with lots of trouble associated with it. And you had a German 18th-century composer coming out of a Lutheran tradition, and Luther, unfortunately, his most famous work today probably is his diatribe of 1543 called On the Jews and Their Lies. And given those two things alone, one might think there isn't even really any need for discussion. And so I think it's fair to say that folks just assumed there was going to be a great deal of trouble with Bach's setting of a piece like this, but didn't really put a lot of effort into finding out exactly what Bach did with it. And once that educational opportunity was thoroughly explored, I think things calmed down quite a bit because of that.
Michael, what is the problematical part of the Gospel of St. John?
Well, the main trouble with John is that it has many of these dualisms that are common in literature of the first century, where you conceptualize the whole cosmos as a battle between evil on the one side, good on the other, light versus darkness, that sort of thing. And what's interesting and problematic about John is that it places the Jews on the side of darkness and the followers of Jesus of Nazareth on the side of light. And curiously, then, the term which might otherwise be translated, or many scholars have been arguing the Greek term that John uses ought to be translated as the Judeans, who are on the side of evil here then, and that it didn't have an exclusively religious connotation until several centuries later, are on this side of darkness, and the Galileans, another geographical area, are on the side of goodness. One little problem with that, though, is that once the Galileans in John 6, for example, start to doubt Jesus as a preacher, curiously, John starts to call them Judeans or Jews, depending how you translate it. So it seems that John's one of the first people to hint in the direction of associating religious Judaism with darkness and negativity and evil and so on. The idea then, of course, that Jesus is going to die on the cross and this death is going to affect this victory over evil.
So there's the problem or the question in John. There's no real question about Luther's translation. There's questions about his attitude to begin with, not about his translation of the Greek into German.
Yeah, that's right. Now, Luther consistently translates that arguably ambiguous term as die Juden, so he understands it as the Jews, exactly.
But then what does Johann Sebastian Bach do with this text, and how do his own commentaries reveal his own interpretation of the story?
Well, here's where there's some really interesting things that happen in both the John Passion and the Matthew Passion. Bach is almost sort of modern and ecumenical in the way that he puts a spin on this story. One modern spin that I don't find very satisfying is that some folks will say, well, everyone is a Jew, everyone is evil, and needs to be redeemed by this God become man. That does soften the anti-Judaism of the gospel somewhat, but it doesn't in many other ways. What Bach doesn't take that tack, though, what he just doesn't engage the issue of Judaism at all. The commentary focuses exclusively on his congregants in the 1720s, 30s, and 40s in Leipzig, and what he constantly says things is like, to give a quick example, when the attendant of the Jews is depicted as slapping Jesus across the face for not being respectful enough towards the high priest and says, is that any way to talk to the high priest? Then that's a golden opportunity for composers like Telemann and Handel when they come to that part of the story, where they'll comment on it by saying things like, yeah, what do you expect from a Jew? Of course, they're going to slap my Savior around and that sort of thing. But in the St. John Passion, at that point, in comes a chorale that starts, Wer hat dich geschlagen, which means, who is it that has struck you?
Michael, we have that cued. Let's just play it, and then you come in and comment on it when you like.
That's terrific.
Here's the music. What is Bach's answer to the question, who has hit you like that?
Yeah, here the key moment is in this second stanza that's playing right now of the chorale. The answer becomes, ich, ich, und meine Sünden, which means I, and my sins, which are as numerous as the grains of sand on the seashore. They have caused the sorrow that strikes you and the grievous host of pain. That's what they're...
Let's listen.
With this thing. It's a curious sort of logic where they say the logical cause of Jesus 2,000 years ago having been struck across the face is the fact that you and I right now are a sinful human being. That's the idea.
This is also a perfect example of one of the challenges of performing this work, because at once the chorus is the part of the crowd, and then immediately has to turn around and sing something like this, which is really... sort of self-searching and pietistic in its quality. It's a completely different world. So, particularly in the St. John, where there's these intense turba choruses that are part of the action, and then immediately some sort of different contemplative world, the whole group needs to just change their emotional energy on a dime. And it really takes not only a bunch of singers, but a bunch of acting singers to pull this off and really get the point across.
Here, I should throw in a quick footnote here. Bach, sorry, is an extremely careful studier of Scripture. He has a huge theological library himself, hundreds of sermons, particularly on the Passion narrative, and these massive commentary Bibles and so on. He paid very close attention to the differences in the stories in the different Gospels. And one of the things that folks do an awful lot nowadays is to conflate story elements from the different Gospels. The classic example, of course, is the wise men coming to the manger to give gifts to Jesus at the beginning of the Gospel. Those are two different traditions from two very different stories. And where that's relevant here is that the idea of there being a crowd at the Passion narrative, that's only in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in John, the word crowd never appears in the Passion narrative. And Bach is aware of this. It's just a group of chief priests and their attendants that are there, and that has an effect on how one understands what's going on in the story as well.
Michael Merson, we're lucky to have you on this program. We're talking about the passions of Johann Sebastian Bach, the stories of the death of Jesus from the Gospels of St. Matthew, and another complete work from the Gospel of St. John, and specifically about the question of who killed Jesus, and what is the blame being cast here on the Jews? 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. Ricardo is on the line.
Hi. When I was in college, I had a very moving experience listening to The Passion According to St. John being played for a music appreciation class, and that was really scary.
Yep.
Matthew's more moving, but John is really scary. But I, over the years, thinking about this, I've sort of had some thoughts about why is it called the Passion? And I have a little riddle to ask you. If passive is the opposite of active, what is the opposite of action?
Okay.
Oh, good. Michael's still on the line.
Yes.
Super technically, the Passion narrative in the Gospel of John is not a Passion narrative at all. It's only a Passion narrative, strictly speaking, in Matthew, Luke, and Mark.
Yes.
Because Passion is a technical term, meaning a story about the suffering of...
That's exactly the point. People, the word pathology, the word patient,
right.
The word passive, the word passion, all come from the root meaning to suffer, which means to be acted upon.
Absolutely. And the thing that's different about John's gospel is that he's very keen to structure the whole gospel in such a way that Jesus always knows what's going to happen to him. He's in total control. And in fact, he doesn't appear really to suffer on the cross per se, because in John's conception of who Jesus is, his victory over the between good and evil is secured already on the cross, whereas in the other three Gospels, the victory is secured only at Easter.
Right.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, the brilliant thing you said is that when Bach says to his congregants that all of our sins were caused pain to Jesus, that does take the whole thing out of time and put all of us together at Sinai receiving the Ten Commandments from God. And whenever one is in a religious ecstatic state, one is not in time. And passion, of course, I was always wondering, well, does the passion imply there's something sexual about Jesus as being a masochistic on the cross? I never understood that word. But of course, we have to remember that on Olympus, Eros, the god of love, was the only god who could wound the other gods. He could send an arrow into Apollo and cause him to fall in love with a tree. So that he was the only god the other gods feared. It's always passion which wounds us most deeply.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, there are more than 30,000 books and articles evidently written solely on the Gospel of John, and all sorts of contextual stuff has been drawn upon. Every conceivable way of looking at it has been mined, and there's many more to come, I'm sure.
And from Ricardo, too, probably. Ricardo, thank you. Thank you for joining us. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the St. Matthew and St. John Passions of Johann Sebastian Bach, and specifically this puzzling question of what the role of the Jews as Jews means and meant. 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation. Alice is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Alice.
Thank you. I really wanted to talk a little bit about the St. Matthew because I encountered it the first time when I was a teenager and listened to it from beginning to end with a new stereo. Remember, you had to put the speakers 8 feet apart, hi-fi. And what I found was that I believe that every human emotion is on display from in the St. Matthew, from the lullabies at the end to the screaming crowds, and having sung it, it is, as you pointed out, extremely challenging to go from one emotion for the crowd calling for his death to the totally different tone of the chorale. I tend to believe that the opening chorus of the St. Matthew may be the greatest piece of music ever written.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
And the other thing is that, you know, as I understand it, originally this was not a concert piece, but sort of sing-along, since the churchgoers knew the chorales.
It actually was not a sing-along, but it was definitely conceived and performed in a liturgical setting. With a sermon between the two parts and chorales beginning and ending the service. However, the chorales were probably not sung along by the congregation, but they were definitely aware of the text, and these would be as familiar tunes to them as perhaps the national anthem is to us.
Mm-hmm.
Alice, what's the Jewish question here for you?
As a Jewish person, I find the references in the St. John's actually very disturbing, and I have not sung the St. John's, and I tend to avoid it. My mother used to tell me that Bach had applied for a new job somewhere, and they said, well, send a sample of your work, and so what he sent was the St. John's, like a resume. But
that's actually not true, I don't think. Because he composed the St. John after he was in Leipzig.
While
at Leipzig, yeah.
But you know, and then I think, well, let's see, you know, there's historically informed performances where, you know, people play on instruments that nobody uses anymore. And, you know, it's, shall we say, historically correct if you think about what the point of view was at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't have an answer.
Yeah,
I wish I did have an answer.
Right.
I basically do find it disturbing. And I just wanted to...
How do you Julian walked in minister to people who find the St. John disturbing.
That's what's keeping Michael so busy these days. Because I did the St. John 2 weeks ago in Providence, Rhode Island with the Providence Singers, and I'm doing it again this Sunday at BU. And then the St. Matthew. But in making the decision to do this work, and particularly with the Providence Singers, because a good 30-40% of the group is Jewish, we had to have serious discussions, and a couple people bowed out of the program because of that. But, you know, as somebody, because my father is Jewish, and my whole paternal lineage goes back to chief rabbis in Hanover and whatnot, and my mother's Roman Catholic, so it's, you know, that's an interesting combination. But I also feel, you know, a personal connection to this issue, and I actually have a bigger problem with the mainline in St. Matthew, which is let his blood be on us and our children's children. I think that is a more problematic statement for me. Yeah,
can
Michael,
I jump in on some of this one?
Please, Michael Morrison.
A little bit to you. That's hands down the most disturbing single verse in the New Testament on this issue.
Right.
The original Greek there reads just his blood on us and our children. There's no verb. And most translators provide one, either be or come. And the way Luther translated it was, let's see, sein Blut komme über uns und unsere Kinder, which would mean literally his blood come over us and over our children. Mm-hmm. And what was intriguing to me, that this is another one of those classic places to see what other composers do with that text. And indeed, Telemann will say, of course, you know, this cursed nation has brought a curse upon itself. In fact, in one of Telemann's more famous passion settings, the Das Selige Erwägen, at this point in the piece, he specifically says, so you call out, you cursed sinners, his blood come over us and over our children.
Michael Morrison, hold the thought. It's a big one, but we'll be right back. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Bach Passion Connection.
Aber Pilatus soll, dass nicht schaffte, sondern dass ein Tiergrüße getümmel ward. Nahm Wasser und wusch die Hände vor dem Volk und sprach: Ich bin unschuldig an dem Blut dieses Gerechten, sehet ihr zu. Da antwortete das ganze Volk und sprach:
Sein Blut, sein
This is the chorus in which the Jewish crowd said, his blood be on all of us and on all our children and our children's children.
It also happens right after Pilate washes his hands of the whole mess.
Right. Michael Morrison, this is exactly what you were speaking of from the St. Matthew Passion of Johann Sebastian Bach.
Yes, that's right. This is a key moment in the Matthew Passion. This is the one spot that everyone's the most curious about at these various lectures that I do and so on. And this has been used as justification for anti-Jewish violence for centuries. And so it's a spot that you can sort of gauge how a composer what he thinks this part of the story means. And Telemann and other composers like that will typically at this point say something along the lines of, you know, what an accursed people this is, and what's a curse and damnation for them, then now becomes a blessing. I'm going to go to heaven and they're going to go to hell, basically, is the commentary. That happens, for example, in the, as I was beginning to mention, the Telemann Oratorio, Das Selige Erwägen. So Bach, however, has a completely different tack here. He waits a little while before he breaks into commentary. And then there's an alto aria that the alto aria that starts Können Tränen meiner Wangen. If the tears on my cheeks can achieve nothing, then take my heart. And here's a key moment that's continually mistranslated because modern readers of German don't know theological German.
Right.
It reads here, it says at this point, wenn die Wunden milde bluten, auch die Opferschale sein, which means, it's usually translated as, when the wounds bleed gently, let my heart be the sacrificial cup that comes to catch the blood, like in the old paintings that you see where someone's standing on the cross and a big arch of blood will come streaming into a communion cup. Well, the word milde in modern German means gently, but in Bach's theological library, that word is used, means abundantly or copiously in the theological sense. So the idea here is that there's enough blood for everyone to bless them. And it goes farther than this. And in these commentaries, they say this is the New Testament example of the thing that happened only once in the Hebrew Scriptures, and that was when Moses gave the law to the people at Sinai, he sprinkled sacrificial blood on the people as the way of blessing them. So Bach's theological materials tie those two ideas together. The blood that looks like a curse here in the New Testament is in fact a blessing of the sort that Moses sprinkled on the people centuries before. And that's made clear then in a subsequent aria. This is the central idea of the whole St. Matthew Passion that's laid out in the recitative Ach Golgotha. It says, let's see, I've got it in front of me here somewhere. Yes, the blessing and the salvation of the world appears as a curse on the cross. So the whole Lutheran idea here is that things appear one way, but they actually are very different from that. And so what happens then at this part of the piece, the choir sings this ferocious, his blood come over us and our people. So this thing that looks ferocious and awful, in fact, then becomes a blessing.
And it is interesting that the chorus starts in B minor but ends in triumphant D major. I mean, I think that supports
precisely. Yeah. Yes, this is the music that the musical elements underline this too. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Julian Wachner in our studio is conducting both the St. Matthew and St. John Passions in Boston this week. Michael Morrison joins us from Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. He's the author of a very significant study called Lutheranism, Anti-Judaism, and Bach's St. John Passion. We're talking about the blame that is cast on the Jews in the Gospels and very dramatically in these melodramatic passions of Johann Sebastian Bach. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Bach Passion connection. Horace Allen joins us by phone. He's a professor of worship at the Boston University School of Theology, and he'll be preaching with the Passion performances this coming weekend. Horace Allen, how do you preach from the Passions?
I have always said that I felt sorry for the preachers in Bach's day who had to do this job. It's unenviable at best. The competition is rather severe. However, it's also one of the greatest delights in my preaching career to be able to do this, because you can't go into the pulpit with a more complex but at the same time rich and fascinating support system. It's as though you hardly have to open your mouth, or as Bach himself said about playing the organ, you just open your mouth and the right words will come out. He said that the organ is easy to play. You just push the right notes down and it plays itself. Now, vis-a-vis, of course, the problem that is in discussion now has developed of late, and this provides for the preacher a somewhat awkward situation. One would prefer to go along with Bach's own preaching and homiletical wisdom, but now there is this great communications problem, which at least has its roots in the fact that this liturgical work of art has been ripped out of its frame and placed in a totally different context. I remember seeing Michael the Pietà at the World's Fair, and it had all of its power, but it was in such a terrible place. And you begin noticing the wrong things. Mm. This is the problem here. That is, this is a liturgical piece. Further, it is based not in Luther's writings, as a current article has said, but in the Bible, which Luther simply translated and which was read in the church all the time. Again, plucking it out of the church creates these problems. Julian alluded very interestingly to the fact that for the chorus, it's a fiendish switch to make from singing those wild chorales then into a meditative, the wild choruses into a meditative chorale.
Right.
But of course, as Julian has said, the chorale is now appealing to the people. whereas the chorus is simply reciting the text of the Bible. That is, worship is the recitation of a text in one way or another, and a pious or faithful response. That's lost once it moves into the concert hall, and then these problems develop. I'm happy that the other guests have pointed out that the John Passion has its own preoccupations other than Matthew, one of them being, as was said, that Jesus is totally in charge here. And this would be my major response to the anti-Semitic question. That is, in my estimation, I'm not a New Testament scholar, and I'm sure my colleagues will be at me in no time if I'm off the rails. John is setting up a kind of political fencing match.
Yes.
Between Pilate, representing Rome, and the Jewish leadership of the time. Now, this was a very tense political situation because there was, for instance, a king of the Jews, namely Herod. And the leadership of the Jewish religious situation were playing along with that one for reasons best known to themselves. That is to say, the issue here is Pilate and the other leadership of the time, and Jesus, in a way, is in the middle, but oddly and interestingly, in charge of both. And what John sets up isn't an anti-Semitic situation, but a political situation which precisely mirrors the historical situation, which people now don't understand. Not only is Jesus himself a Jew, but also he's referred to, rather powerfully in this, as the king of the Jews.
Mm.
And by whom? By Pilate. Now, and Pilate makes that affirmation about the inscription on the cross wearing his purple robes, namely the significance of the emperor. So Pilate actually, in the fourth gospel, declares Jesus to probably be the true king.
Right, but this is a shift also because the John gospel, I'm not sure if we mentioned this, the John gospel is written almost 100 years later than the other gospels.
Quite right, and it's written at a time when it is not the case that Christians are persecuting Jews.
Right.
But the synagogue was chucking the Christians out.
Well, yes, at least according to John, anyway. I'm not sure there's quite 100 years between the Gospels.
No, probably not. No.
They're saying the other three are written right around after the destruction of the temple, I think is one of the consensus, and John's around the year 100 or so. But one important historical point to make here is that it's only what we now call Jews wouldn't have called Jesus, even if they thought he was a king, they wouldn't have called him the king of the Jews. They would call him the king of Israel. It's only Romans and other Gentiles that would use the word Jew at all to refer to someone. And so that language already involves some distancing, I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think it's time for the phones and for the voice of music lovers of all persuasions. We're talking about what some people find a deeply troubling anti-Semitic thread in the Passion Plays of Johann Sebastian Bach, St. Matthew and St. John. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Carolyn is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Carolyn.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how is everybody?
Good. Good.
I'm really enjoying this. This is a rich discussion, and it really speaks to my condition, as my Quaker friends would say. I'm a Jewish parent of a Swarthmore graduate who was at Swarthmore in the spring of 1996. During the incident that Professor Morrison refers to in his New York piece, that wonderful article in the New York Times, where you referred to the media frenzy at Swarthmore over this very issue. And this is really healing me, this discussion. I wish we could have had something like this at that time. It was Parents' Weekend. It was the week before Passover. And St. John's was being performed at Swarthmore during Parents' Weekend, and a lot of us Jewish parents came down instead of staying home preparing for Passover because we wanted to be with our kids. The kids were hysterical. A lot of Jewish kids on campus were upset for the very reasons you're discussing, the whole Jewish issue in relation to this passion. And I had heard that Professor Morrison held an incredible honor seminar with his own students talking about this issue. But the campus at large and the parents were not privy to that. And there was a lot of dissent among the students because they wanted to have a teach-in that would, which is what essentially what you're doing on this wonderful show, teasing out these issues. And they also wanted comments on the libretto so that people who didn't get to the teach-in could see that this was not being presented without understanding that there were problems. And the administration was really harsh on the students, and there was a lot of pain. And I wondered why Professor Morrison wasn't able to get the administration to do what you're doing now, which is essentially giving a teach-in for the people before the BU performance at the same sensitive time of year.
Some of these things take time, but why did it take so long, Michael Morrison?
Well, this is a complicated issue, but I don't. The main problem was that it wasn't really a fault, I don't think, of the administration or the students or the faculty. What happened was there was an enormous amount of misinformation circulating around very publicly because many media folks, of course, thrive on the idea of controversy, and so they would continually misreport what other folks were saying and would try to set them against each other. And so I think the vast majority of the difficulties in that semester were media-driven and were not particularly educational. I had planned already from the very beginning of the semester various lectures and seminars on the topic, and some students were complaining that there weren't educational opportunities, and we just say, you know, but there are, and we've got them planned already. And then in spite of all that, even though some of those students were happy enough with that, it would end up getting reported in the Associated Press that the faculty was completely unaware of the issues and so on and so forth. So I think it was mostly certain elements of the press like to be able to make fun of college like Swarthmore and its supposed political correctness and liberalness and so on. But on the whole, I thought that all the way around, it's a fairly sensitive and intelligent community. There was just systematic miscommunication, I think, because of these press difficulties.
Well, we're talking about it now, and we'll talk about it as long as need be. 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation.
I would also just like to add that frankly, 1996 to now is a very quick amount of time in terms of scholarship, and the fact that Michael was able to produce a book in really probably under 2 years from that event is...
I finished it within a few... I would have finished it during that semester if I had opportunity to do so, but I actually finished it in about a month or so after school ended. So, all the stuff was available to me already at that point.
Right.
1-800-423-TALK. Joins the connection. Bernie is calling from Newton, Massachusetts.
Is this my friend Bernie?
Absolutely.
Hi.
Hi, Julian. Hi, Michael. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Bernie.
Hi, Bach. Thank you all the in group. We've been using two words here. I think Julian brought them out in his very first sentences, anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism, that I think are very different, and the difference between them is not generally appreciated because of traditional attitudes that are very, very old. There's a difference between antagonism towards people and groups hostile to Jesus' ministry now or then, saying, "Why, we don't like you because you don't believe what Jesus says, or you should believe what Jesus says," and Hitler-style ethnic hostility towards people whom the hater says, "Well, these people are Jews, and not only don't they go to church on Sunday, but they do bad things towards matzahs and X, Y, and Z." And the latter is really something that arose in the 19th century from racial theories of Count Gobineau and Chamberlain and people like that. And the antagonism in the New Testament and in Luther, and in the Bach Passions, is really something directed towards those people who were, quote, Jews, quote, at the time, who did not believe in or follow Jesus and said, no, he's not our king, you know, we don't like him. And even Luther spent a great deal of effort before on the Jews in their lives trying to convert Jews to make them be Christians and became really angry when they didn't and wrote this terrible book, you know, Die Juden und Lügen. And this view of Judaism as a tribe is really something rooted in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, and traditional Jewish theology. And in some sense, Hitler is more believing of that theology than Paul or Luther or Bach.
Yeah, I guess what I would say quickly to that is that anti-Semitism is different from anti-Judaism.
That's right.
It's a lot worse thing, but anti-Judaism is still very bad and serious.
Interesting. Bernie, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Howard is on the line. Hello, Howard. Howard, are you there? 1-800-423-TALK. Rick is on a car phone.
Hello, Chris.
Hello, Rick. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Excellent show, as always.
Thank you.
I just wanted to reinforce what was said at the bottom of the hour and has been said a number of times since, which is, in fact, this is more a theological question than it is a musical question. I believe that Bach and Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were basically reflecting a theological idea, which is that Jesus was, in fact, the Paschal Lamb introducing the new covenant. He was not purporting to be a political king. He was a theological king. And just as Moses sprinkled blood, that's the concept behind Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. And that it isn't an anti-Semitic thing, as has just been mentioned. It is, in fact, an offer of hope. It's not good over evil. It's life over death. And if people take the music out of context, if they take the theology out of context, they're going to misinterpret what is, I believe, an honest attempt to represent a theological premise which is firmly grounded in the Old Testament. That's about all I have to say. Thank you very much.
And the work...
Rick, thank you.
Sorry to interrupt. Yes, I think the work is... incredibly cosmic in its theological statements, but the other thing that is also in the work are things that are very human in their qualities. For instance, Peter's denial of Jesus or Judas's betrayal. Those are things that we've all done as people. Mistakes we've made in our lives, friends we've hurt, things that we've felt awful about, and I think even those little issues are reflected in the work as well.
The only other thing I would quickly add in here is that. If Christians may interpret the death of Jesus as having sacrificial significance and so on and so forth, and that makes they have every right to do that, and that's indeed what the Gospels are saying. But Jesus would never have been killed by Pilate for such beliefs or for such theological constructs. The only way he would have been killed by Pilate in the first place is for some political problem, as, for example, being considered by at least some folks to be the king of Israel, the king,
sedition,
of, the, king of the Jews. So the theological interpretation is not only appropriate, but it's actually absolutely called for, because otherwise the event can only happen in the first place on historical grounds, and then it doesn't make any sense to followers of Jesus unless you interpret it theologically.
Last call is Anne in Pocatello, Idaho.
Hello.
Hi, Anne. Welcome.
Hi, Anne.
Thank you very much. I'm calling as a Catholic, and I just wanted to say that every year and every Holy Week, we read the Passion as a part of our Mass, and the congregation takes the part of the crowd, and it's quite moving when we are to call out, "Crucify Him," and the definite lesson being that, that we are the ones who are responsible for the crucifixion of Christ, and that we are also the ones who denied Christ and continue to deny Christ and are still guilty of that. And so we see it as our responsibility and not the responsibility of the Jews long ago, that it's an ongoing.
And well said. I want to give Horace Allen, the preacher, the last word here.
Thank you very much. I do want to take, I appreciate the call in just a few moments ago that said this is a theological and not a political matter. The subtlety, of course, is, as I think, the fourth gospel is using a political matter to make some theological points. And it is not, I think, accidental at all that, in a sense, Pilate comes off as perhaps a weak politician, but a good guy, in that he does give in, but he keeps protesting the innocence of Jesus. It is not, I think, surprising, therefore, and we should remember this, that every time the creeds are spoken in the Christian church, his name is mentioned.
Right. And, suffered under Pontius Pilate.
Yeah, crucified under Pontius Pilate. And that's, as it were, not to accuse Pilate, but rather to keep his position there in almost as a proto-witness to the innocence of Jesus. And I would have to take, if I may, just a little, at the end, issue with Professor Marison, who said this is a conflict between the Jews and the followers of Jesus. The followers of Jesus don't come off very well either. That also is Bach's sort of point. So I think...
Horace Allen, we're going to go out on the final chorus of the St. John Passion, in which they're saying, in German, of course, "O Lord, send your cherubs." Thank you, Julian Wachner. Thank you, Michael Morrison and Horace Allen, and to all the callers. We had help today from John Hoder, Tim Monroe, Dan First, Rebecca Smucker, and Kim Bichari. The connections produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Here and Now at noon, in addition to a look at opening day at Fenway, we'll meet the author of the children's book called Zachary's Ball.